evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impulga. This evening we talk about the situation in Sudan. And with us tonight is my colleagues, Vincent Macori, Managing Editor at TV English Africa. Vincent, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure.
You're very much welcome. And joining us also is my other colleague, Nabil Biagio. He's from the VOA's Sudan service. Welcome to the show, Nabil.
Thank you for having me.
You're very much welcome. As I say, tonight we're looking at the situation in Sudan. The Sudan military seized power in October, and the coup has plunged Sudan into political stalemate and relentless street protests that have brought the deaths of more than 60 people so far. Nabil, let me begin with you. What's the latest? Because recently there are people, protesters were killed, and the situation seems to be a bit fragile.
Yes, thank you, Douglas, and greetings to you and your listeners. I was in Sudan the first and second week of January, and the situation is quite difficult, quite abnormal. The daily flow of things is often disrupted by road blockades, internet service, outages, and the economic conditions are biting hard. Now, as you followed, Monday was a deadly day as another wave of protests was staged and seven people were gunned down in one day and scores of others injured. And since then, the organizers of the protests declared a countrywide campaign of civil disobedience. Now, for the last 2 days, Tuesday and Wednesday, at least the capital Khartoum, but also other towns, is in a near total state of paralysis. Even public transportation is not working. Most of the markets are closed. And where I think it stands right now, the streets, the young women and men who oppose the military coup of October 25th are determined to make the country ungovernable for the military, and they refuse to be governed without their consent. And because of the bloodshed, the street is now radicalized and unafraid. They might be broken, the protesters, they are broken, traumatized, but they're not fearful, and they're still defiant. And on the other hand, or the other side of the confrontation, of course, is the military, which will not budge and will not hesitate to shoot live ammunition into protesters. So this is where things stand now.
I see. Vincent, Sudan, is, as Nabil mentions there, seems to be now ungovernable. It's been several months without clarity.
It has been ungovernable, for sure, and that is because, you see, the citizens of Sudan, especially the younger generation, tasted civilian rule, at least partially, when they forced Omar Bashir out of power and the transitional government was formed. But then, of course, the downside was that the military still continued being part of the system, part of the government. In fact, to a large extent, the military continued to call the shots. So while there was a veneer of civilian rule, there was a kind of a little token of civilian rule. The military has refused to completely disengage itself from the running of the affairs of Sudan. And we've seen what has happened. The prime minister initially, of course, was kicked out. Then they persuaded him to come back, and he himself just gave up. And there is a reason for this. I have said it before in our discussions. Militaries, the armies, are not democratic institutions. The armies have never been designed to run governments. They're made up of commanders and soldiers, men who ostensibly are there to defend their countries against external aggression. So when it comes to running of a government, running the affairs of a nation, the militaries can never truly run a government in a way that will be satisfactory to a citizen, whether it's conscious of their rights, of their civil rights, of their human rights. And because the militaries don't know how to negotiate, they're run by orders and rules commands. It becomes impossible for citizens to really accept that kind of arrangement. So as long as the military in Sudan insists that they have to be part of this government, it is going to be a very easy relationship with the citizenry. And also we are likely to witness more bloodshed. Now, the difference between the past and this present time we're living in is that in the past, the people were completely subjugated by Omar al-Bashir, except, of course, we saw what happened in Darfur as people were fighting for their rights there, and, of course, in South Sudan, which eventually became a country. But the people of Khartoum and the other parts of Sudan, as we know it today, are now aware and conscious of what they deserve, and that is purely civilian rule. And so I can see the situation not getting any better unless and until the militaries, the soldiers, go back to where they belong, to the barracks, and let the government of Sudan be led by a civilian entity.
I see. Nabil, this turmoil now intensified following the resignation of Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok, after he failed to reach a compromise between the military and the pro-democracy movement. Do you think he was naive in the beginning to how to agree to this arrangement, or what do you think of his timing of resignation?
That's a good question. Before we get into it, I would like just to caution against hinging. So what is happening in Sudan is something way bigger than an individual, whether it's Hamdok or anyone else. It's a process. It's an attempt by hopeful young women and men to change the way things have been run for decades since Sudan's independence. When Hamdok came in, Hamdok was, of course, a high-profile, well-respected UN official. He's worked in the region and beyond. But he was not prepared for the messy politics of Sudan. He did what he could. When he was ousted, arrested, but then again returned to power by the military, he was already looking weak in the eyes of the protesters who wanted change, fundamental change. So he had a tough decision to make. And while he was running out of time, young men and women were dying in the streets of Khartoum and other places in Sudan every day. And the military was moving to consolidate power. He didn't have a cabinet. He was just returned as prime minister, as Hamdok. He didn't have a civilian cabinet. And while he was away, the military returned a lot of the executives and officials who served in the previous administration, the Bashir administration. So in his resignation letter, this is what we can interpret his situation based on, because we cannot speculate. He said he tried to return the country back on track to pursue the transition to democracy, but he failed, and he acknowledged that and apologized to the Sudanese people. And then he said, the trust you gave me, now I am handing back things to you and wish you good luck. And he said, honestly, I think Sudan is at a crossroad, on the verge of an abyss. There's an existential crisis that Sudan is facing. And I wish you good luck and sorry for failing you. So I don't think there was much he could do Prime Minister, as an individual who rose to that position on the backs of the street protests, and the price for that was the blood of innocent young men and women. He had no choice but to seek an honorable exit at that point.
I see. Vincent, but some people are saying there's no way the military will seize power and then pretend they are sharing that power with a civilian organization. Is that possible?
You're actually reading my mind, exactly what I wanted to say. There can never be a collaboration between the civilian, a civilian and a military person in running a government. These two are totally different in the way they approach issues, in the way they exercise power and authority. The militaries, as I've just said, are not a democratic institution. They are structured so differently, and soldiers function differently. You can never have a government that is a union between the military and the civilian and expect it to function, because while the civilian leadership is expecting to talk and negotiate and vote on issues, the mindset of the military is to give orders and have absolute power. The soldiers, the generals, don't know how to deal with the civilians. And therefore, it will never work as long as the soldiers continue being in control. And what we have in Sudan is that while they try to bring a civilian face to this government, the military controls the government of Sudan. The military controls all the structures. So there is no way Prime Minister Hamdok would succeed to achieve the objectives of the citizens of Sudan who are on the street. And unfortunately for him, the expectations were too high. The civilians of South Sudan, citizens of Sudan were expecting him to run Sudan, turn the corner, and make it a democratic functioning country after many years of dictatorial military regime of Omar Bashir. That could never and can never be achieved while the shadow of Bashir still exists, which means when we have military guys still in control in the government, when you have actually the armies having the upper hand, that can never allow for a democratic kind of a system in Sudan. The only solution, obviously, will have to be militaries step away. The transitional government in any way should have been a fully civilian government, which would be charged with organizing proper democratic elections as soon as possible. There is absolutely no reason for the army, for the military to be involved in the transitional government. The army should continue as it's supposed to, playing their role as the protectors of the nation from any external aggression. The only part they would play is to ensure the security in the country on the borders of Sudan with the rest of the world. But to say, to expect that you can have a government that is a mix of the army and the civilian and hope that they can function, no, it cannot work. And you can, if you were to have a private conversation with Hamdok, he probably would tell you that for all the time that he was there, he probably had a very difficult time trying to negotiate, trying to discuss, to reach consensus with the commanders, with the generals, because they operate on a totally different universe, and it doesn't function in any world, in any part of this world, in running a proper democratic system in any country.
I see. And now, for those just joining us, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable. We're coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. Tonight, we're discussing the situation in Sudan. And our panelists are my colleagues, Vincent Macquarie, Managing Editor at TV English Africa, and Nabil Biagio of the VOA Sudan Service. Nabil, Vincent just mentioned how these things can't work, but to some people, it's a catch-22 situation. The protesters and those fighting for democracy are saying they want a fully civilian government. The military says it would only hand over power to an elected administration. does that one work? Where does it end? Where do you start? Because one can't, you can't have it both ways. One has to happen first. Who gives way first?
Well, the statement that they could only hand over power to an elected government, we have to take it with a grain of salt. How did that elected government come into place? They had an agreement. The military would chair the sovereign council for the first half of the transitional period, and then a civilian would take over for the rest of the transitional period, and then the nation would go to elections. But that process was disrupted by a military takeover where the prime minister himself was arrested. So you have to look at their actions and their behavior, not their statements. But also going back since Sudan's independence, the military has ruled the country for so many decades. We only had brief civilian partisan democratic periods in Sudan, very brief. For the majority of Sudan's independence, the military was in power and always had the upper hand. So it is a catch 22 situation, I agree, because the streets now, this young generation that has accumulated this experience with the military, and they looked at their history, they see no other way but a total exit of the military from politics. And that's going to be hard. It's going to be a long road. There's going to be more killings. But they hope that there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel. We don't know how the nation is going to get there and whether it's going to be a straightforward, like a linear trajectory, or there's going to be back and forth, regression and all of that. But that's what they're determined to do. You know, now if you notice, there is a mediation process led by the UN, the special representative of the Secretary General and the head of the UN mission in Sudan, Volker Perthes. But he has no interlocutors. He has no, like, so these diplomats and these officials, they're used to, like, you have two protagonists, you bring them around the table, you negotiate, you compromise. But that's not the situation in Sudan anymore. There is the streets, radicalized youth who have seen death, who have faced live ammunition, who are determined to remove the military altogether from power. And there is the military that will not hesitate to shed blood to continue to rule. So that formula, that scenario you presented is no longer viable. It's not applicable in Sudan's context, much to the frustration of the many diplomats and foreign governments who are trying to initiate mediation processes here and there.
I see. Vincent, it's important that Nabil raises that issue. There's been a flood of activity from diplomats, from the United States, European Union, United Nations Human Rights Office. This shuttle diplomacy doesn't seem to be working because it appears, I don't know, maybe as Nabil says, the MO that works along in negotiations doesn't work in Sudan now.
When the military guys seize power and they have control, one of the things they realize is that at the end of the day, it's not so easy for external powers to really force a government or people out of the positions of leadership or the positions of control. First, they know that you cannot leave a vacuum. I mean, what are you going to do in Sudan? Can you by force overthrow the military rule there? And then what? So the only thing that they can hope for is that through diplomacy, kind of a little bit of pressure here, perhaps threats of sanctions, that they can acquiesce a little bit, or just a little ease a little bit and allow some change. The truth, though, is that one of the reasons why you have issues like what you have in Sudan is that nobody should fool you that they can have a taste of power, especially when they have full control of all the apparatus, and then they can just easily want to get out. So this crazy notion that militaries should come to the rescue of civilians by, you know, instituting a government and then ensuring everything is okay and then we can hand over power to a civilian is a fallacy, because remember, with time, these men and women start realizing the power is sweet, that being in those positions of authority is just wonderful, that you're actually in charge of this country. And then, of course, their whole trajectory changes from being protectors of their countries from external, you know, threats to exercising authority internally and, of course, benefiting themselves and their cronies and their families from the largesse of the government of the country. And of course, once you start tasting that honey, you start tasting the nectar of materialism, you want to stay. You want to stay longer. So I can only say, and I've said it before, the only hope for any country emerging from a dictatorship like Sudan is to immediately set up a purely civilian transitional government that is charged with organizing an election within a certain tight period. And ideally, those men and women in the transitional government should not participate in that election that will take place, you know, whenever it takes place. But it should be within a very limited timeline, and that's where the international partners can help to facilitate in terms of just the structure, maybe training for countries where there hasn't been proper elections for years. But the militaries should always stand away and completely uninvolved in the running of a country, because that is not their mandate. Where in the Constitution of Sudan does it say that whenever the government seems to fail, then the military should take over, hold on to power until they think there is a proper civilian government to hand over to? If that was the case, why didn't they do it many years ago when Bashir failed the people of Sudan? Why didn't the guys in that military push him away and set up a government that would necessarily, you know, would help Sudan to kind of, you know, move on to a better place? So this is all never genuine, because they taste power. Power is sweet. Power is corrupting. Power is intoxicating. And that what we've witnessed in many countries is that progressively these men will continue postponing and creating situations which will make it untenable to have an election, and eventually they will transform themselves into the next leaders of that country. Even when they shed off their uniforms, they would want to stay on for as long as it takes.
I see. Well, power is sweet indeed, but Sudan, one of Africa's largest countries, is also facing other challenges, including rising inflation, food insecurity, the coronavirus pandemic. And we now have reports of fresh violence between farmers and herders in the western region of Darfur. Nabil, given all these challenges, where we're talking about international community, where are the neighbors, the regional blocks coming in to help? Briefly, what's their role? Or maybe they don't have any leverage. Briefly.
The region is largely silent at this point. There's no clear initiative. There's no strategy, save for South Sudan, that sent a delegation to Khartoum because South Sudan is concerned about its own interests. The peace agreements in both countries are interlinked. South Sudan is the guarantor of Sudan's peace agreement, and Sudan is the guarantor of South Sudan's peace agreement, and a lot of other security, economic interests. Ethiopia and AU mediators, who were first to start the mediation process early on in the transition period, are largely silent. Maybe Ethiopia is consumed by its own internal crisis. But notably in the region, beyond the sea, across the Red Sea, there are key players like Saudi Arabia. That's where two U.S. diplomats have been meeting with the friends of Sudan and officials there, Saudis, Emiratis, along with Western officials, including the United States, the United Kingdom, and other people, and they are in discussion. That region is important because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are seen as key allies of Sudan, of the military in Sudan, to be specific. And as you know, Sudan is part of the military alliance in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are fighting the Houthis. There is also Egypt to the north, which is also seen as an actor that favors a military dictatorship in Sudan or military rule in Sudan. So as far as the region goes, there isn't much that now can help the situation. And the biggest, generally, the biggest point I would like to make here about the region is that the hopeful and inspiring prospects of a civilian democratic transition in Sudan is fading. And countries that are not in favor of such a process around the Sudan region must be gleeful and assured, probably even emboldened, mm-hmm. To continue doing things their way.
I see. Vicente, in a minute, same question. What happened to the regional blocs, to the IGAD, to whatever?
As always, you know, if you live in a glass house, you cannot throw stones. You just have to look around and ask yourself who in that region has the moral authority to really talk to the government in Sudan. Many are dealing with their own internal problems. A few countries may be, you know, exercising, you know, democracy. You may talk about Kenya. But when you look at what's going on, let's say Sudan is involved. I mean, Ethiopia is involved in its own internal issue. So the leadership there may not have a moral authority to come and talk to Sudan about their own problems. You look at Uganda, perhaps you need to go back in history and ask yourself, how did the person in power come into power? And what are some of the issues that he has to deal with today? If you look, to the other side of Sudan, you know, what are you talking about? You're talking about Chad? You're talking about, I mean, Egypt has its own issues, for example. And so regionally, it becomes very difficult for the leadership to really have moral authority to sit down the military leaders and tell them that you need to get out of power. So it's not as simple, although they may have a semblance of, you know, diplomatic engagement over and over, but I'm never so sure that those ones can yield the most desirable results.
I see. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and that wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. Thanks to my colleagues, Vincent Macori, Managing Editor, TV English to Africa, and Nabil Biagio of VOA's Sudan Service. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the show.
It's always a pleasure.
You're very much welcome. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that you can access the program on our website on the internet. And until next week, I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, wishing you all the best.
NASA says there are some 28,000 comets and asteroids in our planet's neighborhood. The space agency also says the probability of a major collision is quite small. Hi, I'm Rick Bantaleo. Dr. Paul Chodas, manager of NASA's Center for Near-Earth Object Studies, joins me on the science edition of Press Conference USA to talk about asteroids and other near-Earth objects. Listen Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken travels to Kiev this week to reinforce the U.S. commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity as tension continues over the Russian troop buildup along the Russia-Ukraine border. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young, host of the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in right here Mondays through Fridays at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for an action-packed 30-minute program of African, American, and international sports highlights.